shepherds and their wives will be out in this hallway to your left. If you're in need of prayer, then they are there for you. You know, after a couple of baptisms and great service up to this point, with Felicia and Bristol being baptized, sometimes I feel like, hey, the sermon's already been preached. We've learned about God's love and what he's done for us and how we respond, the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. And so I don't know if I have to preach a sermon today, but I will. Not going to let you off that easy. I hope you're excited about being in the Word of God, and I just pray that each one of us, as we hear from the Lord, that he'll touch us and he'll just give us a little bit greater insight into who he is and what he has in store for us. So last week was Covenant Sunday. We introduced the theme of peace, and so I'm going to talk about peace for the next several weeks. But before we get serious, there's a couple of memes here to lighten the mood a little bit. Let's go to that next slide. Yeah, we got, come on, inner peace. I don't have all day. Isn't that kind of what we're like? We want peace, and we want it now. And sometimes this pursuit of peace can rob us of peace. And I like the minion there. My therapist told me the way to achieve true inner peace is to never finish what I start. So far, I finished 2 bags of M&Ms and a chocolate cake. I feel better already. So sometimes we turn to inappropriate ways to find that peace as well. But we want to talk about peace. Peace is a word that's used often in the Old and New Testament. It's the greeting that the Jewish people use. And in fact, it was a greeting that Christians used as well. Paul's letters start often with grace and peace to you. And so peace is something that should mark the Christian life. Now, let me acknowledge there are times in our lives, difficult times that we go through, and we need other people beside us. And so I'm not ignoring those situations where we need a counselor. And we do have a counselor here at Park Avenue. And if you're in a period of your life of unrest, or there's just a struggle that you're going through, then we recognize the value of calling other people alongside to help you as well. But in general, when we read through the Bible and we hear the teachings of Jesus, in general, the Christian life should be marked by peace. When Paul writes to Christians, he talks about the fruit of the Spirit. Here are some qualities that you should experience and some virtues that your life should produce as people of the Spirit. And one of those fruit of the Spirit is peace. And so peace should be something that we should expect, something that we should long for as we enter into a relationship with God and as we come to know him better and better. So last week I proposed this definition of biblical peace. It is imperfect, but it's something that I think gives us some direction into what we're thinking about when we talk about peace. It's the capacity to maintain focus and identity despite our troubles. So in good times and in bad times, when we have this peace, we have this ability to keep in mind what we're all about, what the world is all about. Because sometimes this chaos and turmoil that we go through, it just clouds our vision, doesn't it? And we make bad decisions. We make mistakes because we haven't maintained the focus. We're not seeing things clearly. We're not seeing things the way the Bible reveals things. Truth has been distorted. So we're able to maintain that focus in good times as well, but also in troubled times, and also maintain our identity. Right? This is who I am. I'm a loved child of God. I'm a loved son of God. You are a loved child of God. And so we maintain that identity because sometimes the turmoil and the difficulties of life can, again, distort our perception of how God sees us. Does he really love us? Am I really prized by him? And so when we have this peace, we have this ability. I remain focused. I'm still seeing things clearly, and I know who I am, even in spite of troubles. And in doing so, when I'm able to do this, I have this experience, a calmness of heart and mind. So there's something that comes over me, this peace, this calmness that envelops me as I pursue a worthwhile purpose. My life has a meaning, and what I'm doing has meaning and purpose. And so that brings me this calmness because my life is not going to be derailed by whatever's going on, whether it's good times, whether it's bad times. I have a purpose. I have a function in this world, and I have the confident assurance of a favorable destination. Where I'm going is where I want to be. And even if I have to go through difficult times, I'm going to persevere. I'm going to experience a calmness of heart and mind because I know the decision that I've made is going to lead me to this place that I want to be. So when we talked about peace, we've used two passages in our Covenant Sunday that I want to call your attention to once again. They're both in the Gospel of John. The first one is in John 14 and verse 27. These are the words of Jesus. He says, "Peace I leave with you, my peace I give you. I do not give to you as the world gives." And then he says, "Do not let your hearts be troubled and don't be afraid." So Jesus is saying, this is what I want to do. I want to give out peace. Jesus is giving out peace. And in John 16, 33, he says, "I have told you these things so that in me you may have peace." Jesus wants to lead us to that place. He says, "In the world you will have trouble. Take heart, I have overcome the world." All right, both of these passages, the one in 14 and the one in 16, are part of a larger context. The larger context is John chapters 14 through 16, which is commonly referred to as the upper room discourse. This is where Jesus is in the upper room. This is he washes the apostles' feet. As we put some of the events recorded in the other gospels together as well, this is where he's going to institute the Lord's Supper, which we practice every Sunday. This is where he's going to reveal that someone is going to betray him, reveals that Judas is going to betray him. He has a conversation with Peter, and he says, "Peter, even you are going to deny me." But this is the evening that Jesus is going to be betrayed. After the upper room, he goes to the Garden of Gethsemane, and we have that very passionate, heartfelt prayer, "Not my will, but your will be done." And Jesus is just, he's going through a very difficult time as he is foreseeing and knowing that the cross is in the very, very near future. So Jesus has revealed to his disciples that he's going to die. He's made that clear. They don't actually seem to put all these things together, but Jesus, as we read it, it seems pretty clear that Jesus has told them, "I'm going to be handed over. I'm going to die. I'm going to leave you." And so this naturally is causing a lot of concern, anxiety with the apostles, because they have devoted 3 years of their lives to this rabbi, to this teacher. And so they may be thinking, have I wasted the last 3 years of my life? And if they're after you, are they going to be after me as well? What does this all mean? And so this is a very, I don't even know if we can really describe it. I don't know if I've ever been in a situation like this. This is a very intense, emotional time for Jesus and his apostles. And Jesus wants to make sure that they make it through this. And they are equipped to handle what's going to happen. And then also equipped to take the reins and be the apostles, be the evangelists that they need to be in spreading the word about Jesus. And so Jesus sits down with them. And John records this beautiful speech, 14 through 16. If you have your Bibles open there, if you don't, open your Bibles or your device. If you have a red letter edition of the Bible, those red letters are the words of Jesus. There's going to be a lot of red in 14, 15, and 16 because Jesus kind of takes over the room. He takes the mic and he wants to assure the apostles of some things, some truths that will help them through this difficult time. And so one of the themes of this speech is peace. And so we see peace occur in 14:27 and in 16:33, and especially peace through this very difficult time. So in these two passages, the 14:27 and the 16:33, which are both part of this larger context, I want to point out a couple of things. Number one, to remind you, Jesus is saying, "I am giving out peace," and to ask you the question, do you really believe that? Do you really believe that Jesus is the source of peace, ultimate peace? Because a lot of times we look to other things and other people to bring us peace. So here are some truths. Your spouse is not your source of peace. Your children are not your source of peace. I don't even know if I had to say that one or not, but your children are not your source of peace. Your friends are not your source of peace. Your job is not your source of peace. Your health, your finances, your home, your hobbies, we can go on and on and on. If the answer to that is not Jesus, those are not your source of peace. Now, granted, peace may flow through those relationships, and peace may flow through that security that you have in your marriage or that joy that you have in the job that you have, but it's Jesus's peace flowing through those things that are really the ultimate source of that peace. Jesus is the source, and he's really calling these apostles, do you believe this? You're going to have to believe this if you're going to make it through these troubled times. So a question we need to ask ourselves when we talk about peace is whether or not we are seeking peace in Jesus or whether or not we're seeking peace in someone or something else. Have you ever been in a situation where you got in a line and you weren't really sure if that was the line that you were supposed to be in? But you had to get in some line. Maybe there were two or three lines, and well, I'm going to get in this line right here. And so you get in that line, and then you get to the counter, and they say, you're in the wrong line. You know, isn't that a fun experience? You'll have to go to the end of that line if you want whatever you are asking for. And I think that's what we experience in our lives, don't we? We go through stages where we get in this line, all right, this is going to bring me peace. All right, when I get to the counter, you know, they're gonna dole out all of this peace, and I'm going to be calm. My heart, minds are going to be okay. And then we get to that place, and we think, oh, no, they're not giving out peace. They're giving out a little thrill, or they're giving out a little happiness or something, but they're not giving out peace. And then we find ourselves going to another line, and sometimes we do that over and over. We keep getting in the wrong line, and then hopefully, eventually, we'll realize, all right, there's the Jesus line. I'm getting in that line because he's the one that is handing out peace. Read through the book of Ecclesiastes, and I think that's what Solomon does. That's his story. Solomon's the king after David, and he has access to all of these wonderful things in life, and he keeps getting in the line of wealth, the line of sex, the line of pleasure, the line of everything, and then he realizes every time he gets to the counter, oops, it didn't work. And there's a sense of frustration in the book of Ecclesiastes until the end. And he says, I found the right line. I need to fear God and keep his commandments. So are you convinced, the first thing, are you convinced that Jesus is the source of peace? All right, second thing I want to point out from the passage in John 16:33. You know, Jesus says, I have told you these things so that you might have peace. And so what I want us to do today, beginning today and in the next 4 or 5 weeks, what are these things? What is Jesus talking about? I want us to look at this discourse, this speech that Jesus gives to his apostles, and I want us to start identifying what are these things that Jesus says are going to bring me into this experience of peace. And so again, your homework, read through John 14 through 16. You may want to just take a notepad and start, what are some of these things? What is Jesus saying? What are these truths? What are these realities that Jesus is sharing with the apostles there, sharing with me that are going to bring me to this experience of peace? And so we're going to start at the beginning of this discourse in John chapter 14, verses 1 through 4. This is the introduction to this message that Jesus has for his apostles. And again, just picture the scene. They're in this upper room. There's a lot of anxiety, a lot of uncertainty, a lot of wondering what's going to happen. Jesus starts, he says this. Do not let your hearts be troubled. You believe in God? Believe also in me. My Father's house has many rooms. If that were not so, would I have told you that I'm going there to prepare a place for you? And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come back and take you to be with me, that you also may be where I am. You know the way to the place where I am going. All right, so Jesus starts the speech with the end in mind. He's reminding them of their final destination. He's reminding them of heaven and the certainty of it. Look at these verses. They're just full of all kinds of certainty. I have told you. I go to prepare a place for you. I will come back. You know the way. I mean, there's all of this certainty. This is the one thing that we know is true. This is where we need to start. That there's a place out there. There's a place called heaven that is prepared for me. And as we start this journey to peace, we always have to have the end in mind. Now, this passage is often read at funerals, and appropriately so, but this idea needs to be on our minds our whole life. We need to be people who live our lives with the end in mind and the certainty of that end in mind. I'm reading through several books on peace, and I was surprised as I read through these books. I haven't read through all of them, but just as I begin them and looking through the table of contents, I was surprised that heaven is not more prominent in these verses, in these books. But that's where Jesus starts. And I think about my preaching and our conversations, spiritual conversations, and do we talk about heaven enough? Do we think about heaven enough? Are we excited about going to heaven? And does the thought of living eternally with God, is that bringing peace into our lives? Shouldn't it? You know, we get obsessed with many things. We get obsessed with vacations. We make all these plans. We get excited about these vacations. We spend a lot of money on vacations. We save up for vacations. We get obsessed with vacations. We get obsessed with holidays. We plan and we decorate for Christmas and other holidays. And we get all fired up for those things. We get obsessed about weekends. You know, we can't wait till Friday comes so that we have a weekend. We get obsessed with all of these things. Why are we not more obsessed with heaven? When is the last time that you said anything remotely like what David says in Psalm 16? He says, "No wonder my heart is glad and I rejoice. My body rests in safety, for you will not leave my soul among the dead or allow your Holy One to rot in the grave. You will show me the way of life, granting me the joy of your presence and the pleasures of living with you forever." When have we ever said anything like that? Or I like how the Message puts it. It renders it this way: "I'm happy from the inside out and from the outside in. I'm firmly formed. You canceled my ticket to hell. That's not my destination. Now you've set my feet on the life path, all radiant from the shining of your face. Ever since you took my hand, I'm on the right way." So why don't we say things like this? Or maybe you do. Maybe you do, but I don't know if I'm that obsessed with heaven, if it's always before me. Am I hungry for heaven? Am I hungry for heaven? You know, sadly, some of you, even as you listen to this sermon, you're wondering what you're going to eat for lunch. Now, I am, let's admit it. We advertise our men's retreat, and we talk about the speaker, but we make such a big deal about, we're going to have some good food there. And that's not bad, it's good, but am I hungry for heaven? Am I obsessed with heaven? So I'm going to share with you some reflections from this commentary that I'm using. It's Exalting Jesus in John by Matt Carter and Josh Redberg. And they identify two threats to our appetite for heaven. What is suppressing that appetite? Why aren't we more hungry for heaven? So let me read to you these selections from that book. The first threat, they say, is an unhealthy attachment to earthly things. An unhealthy attachment to earthly things. We can grow so attached to the things of this life that heaven seems like a punishment. The constant consumption of earthly candy has diminished our appetite for the transcendent feast promised in eternity. We need a better perspective on earthly things. Earthly joys are just a foretaste of the full and complete joy we will have in heaven. Why do we love family vacations? Is it the rest and the fellowship? That's a small but imperfect taste of our heavenly rest and fellowship. Why do we love sports? Is it the feeling of exultation and triumph and sharing that with others? That's a small sliver of the triumph and exultation we'll enjoy together in heaven. The pleasures we experience on this earth are gifts from God, but they are designed simply to whet our appetite for the eternally satisfying joys of heaven. Randy Alcorn, in his book on heaven, writes, "Many assume heaven will be unlike earth, but why do we think that? God designed earth for human beings, and nearly every description of heaven includes references to earthly things: eating, music, animals, water, trees, fruit, and a city with gates and streets. The Bible speaks of the new heavens and the new earth, not a non-heavens and a non-earth. New doesn't mean fundamentally different, but vastly superior. If someone says, 'I'm going to give you a new car,' you'd get excited. Why? Not because you have no idea what a car is, but because you do know." Then they go on to say, don't allow earthly things, joys and pleasures, to diminish your appetite for heaven. Ask God to use them to prime your taste buds for heaven's glory." All right, a second suppressant of our joy for heaven is a wrong perspective on Jesus. A wrong perspective of Jesus. All right, let me read to you again. "Have you ever spoken to someone who said he had no desire to go to heaven, sit on the clouds, and strum a harp for all eternity? Some think heaven is endless boredom, like being a monk or a nun forever. No, heaven is about Jesus. Our view of heaven reflects our view of Jesus. The less we think of Jesus here on earth, the less excited we'll be for heaven. If we think of Jesus as a boring, dull, cosmic killjoy, or if we view him as someone who is only to be tolerated, then we will have no appetite for heaven. It's no wonder some of us don't want to spend eternity in heaven with Jesus, since we don't want to take the time here on earth to discover what an inexhaustibly delightful, satisfying, and magnificent Savior he is. Heaven is heaven because Jesus is there. At the apex of their distress, the disciples could remember this promise from Jesus: you will be with me where I am. That promise sustained Abraham as he left his own country and looked for a new city. The presence of Jesus is the promise that sustains us in the midst of difficulties. Like the disciples, we need to cling to the words of Jesus as our hope and confidence while we walk through this fallen, sin-plagued world. You know, when we really understand how wonderful and beautiful Jesus is, then shouldn't it just thrill us? We're going to be with him forever. Maybe you know someone like that. You just love being in their presence. I don't know, you're looking forward to see them. You can't wait until they come for a visit or when they come to a gathering that you have. And there's that person. I mean, they just have that whatever it is, that just brings life into whatever room that they come into. You know, Jesus was that. I mean, read the Gospels, and Jesus was, when he came into a room, he just lit it up. Jesus has brought love and joy and peace and mercy to people who just needed it so much. And so imagine that person that you think, well, I can't wait to see that person, or that person that just has that charisma, whatever it might be. I think that is Jesus, and to be in the presence of Jesus forever should just light us up. It should give us peace on this earth. So we need to be thinking about heaven more. It needs to be constantly in our thoughts, especially in difficult times in life. Heaven is there. Now, there is an argument that is made that some people are so obsessed with heaven that they are of no earthly good. Have you heard that expression before? You know, all this person thinks about heaven and they're just walking on clouds and they're no good to us because they're always somewhere else. I suppose that's possible. Because we do need to be the salt and light of the world. We do need to be engaged in this world. But is that true? Is that the case? Will we be useless here if we are obsessed with heaven? Let me share you some quotes from some very respected and spiritual minds that address that. This is C.S. Lewis in Mere Christianity. He says, "A continual looking forward to the eternal world is not, as some modern people think, a form of escapism or wishful thinking, but one of the things a Christian is meant to do. It does not mean that we are to leave the present world as it is. If you read history, you will find that Christians who did most for the present world were those who thought most of the next, the apostles themselves, who set foot on the conversion of the Roman Empire. the great men who built up the Middle Ages, the English evangelists who abolished the slave trade, all left their mark on earth precisely because their minds were occupied with heaven. It is since Christians have largely ceased to think of the other world that they have become so ineffective in this. Aim at heaven, you'll get earth thrown in. Aim at earth, and you'll get neither. All right. So maybe something that's holding us back is, you know, if I don't want to be too obsessed with heaven, what are people going to think? Am I not going to be any good in this world? And that's just the opposite. The more I'm obsessed with heaven, the more I want to bring the values of the kingdom of heaven into this earth. Listen to what John Piper says. Yes, I know it is possible to be so heavenly minded that we are of no earthly use. My problem is I've never met one of those people. And I suspect if I met one, the problem would not be that his mind is full of the glories of heaven, but that his mind is empty and his mouth is full of platitudes. Think about that. I suspect that for every professing believer who is useless in this world because of otherworldliness, there are 100 who are useless because of this worldliness. Again, we become so obsessed. Let's admit it. I admit it. I'm more concerned about this world so many times than I am about the next. And I think about what's going to happen tomorrow, and I think about what's going to happen next week, and I worry and I'm concerned and all of these things, what's going to happen in 5 years, 10 years, that just robs me of my peace. I need to project further. I need to project to these rooms that Jesus has gone to prepare. That's going to bring me peace rather than worrying about everything in this world. Man, if you just are focused on this world, it's no wonder we don't have peace, isn't it? A.W. Tozer writes this. It has been cited as a flaw in Christianity that it is more concerned with the world to come than with the world that now is. And some have been fluttering about trying to defend the faith of Christ against this accusation. Both the attack and the defense are wasted. No one who knows what the New Testament is about will worry over the charge that Christianity is otherworldly. Of course it is. And that is precisely where its power lies. He goes on to say, let no one apologize for the powerful emphasis Christianity lays on the doctrine of the world to come. Right there lies its immense superiority to everything else within the whole sphere of human thought or experience. When Christ arose from death and ascended into heaven, he established forever 3 important facts, namely that this world has been condemned to ultimate dissolution, that the human spirit persists beyond the grave, and that there is indeed a world to come. He says the church is constantly being tempted to accept this world as her home. And we may want to replace me am constantly being tempted to accept this world as my home. And sometimes she has listened to those who would woo her away and use her for their own ends. But if she is wise, she will consider that she stands in the valley between the mountain peaks of eternity past and eternity to come. The past is gone forever and the present is passing swiftly. Even if the earth should continue 1,000,000 years, not one of us could stay to enjoy it. He says, we do well to think of the long tomorrow. The long tomorrow, isn't that a beautiful phrase? You know, when you're going through difficult times, sometimes I just need to make it through today. Tomorrow will be better. If I can just survive, there's always tomorrow. The sun will come out tomorrow. That's of some consolation, isn't it? But in this world that we live in, we know that tomorrow may be an improvement, but the day after tomorrow, we may be in the same situation. And the day after tomorrow, we may be in the same situation. But I love this phrase that Tozer introduces. We look forward to the long tomorrow, the everlasting tomorrow, where the sun will always shine, where things will always be good, where everything will be made eternally new. And Jesus says at the beginning of the speech, I know this is a terrible day, and tomorrow is going to be even worse. But there's a long tomorrow that's going to sustain you. And that long tomorrow can bring peace to you even in the midst of this difficult time. That's how Jesus starts his speech. He tells him it's going to be all okay because it's going to end well. And to the apostles, he's saying, I know you've loved being with me these 3 years, and it's been, you know, there's been some difficult times, but it's been exciting. And even though things will change, he assures them that we will be together again. He says, while I'm gone, I'm going to be preparing a place for you with a big, big table and a big, big yard and everything that you love to do. All of these things that just give us a taste of heaven, all of those things will be amplified. And so he tells the apostles, you need to keep that close to your heart in good times and bad times, and let that bring you peace. Shouldn't it? Doesn't it? Heaven. We're going to sing a song. It's called, I Know My Redeemer Lives. That sounds like Peter or Paul, doesn't it? You know, it sounds like something you'd see in Peter's writings or Paul's writings, and maybe John, maybe an apostle. I know that my Redeemer lives, but this song is actually inspired by an unlikely God follower. It's inspired by a passage in the book of Job. You know his story, don't you? He suffered mightily. And I can't say if he was at peace. This scripture that we'll read, it seems that he has some level of peace. And maybe a good question to ask Job when you get to heaven, were you at peace? I suspect Job would say, I don't want to talk about those days. Because those days are long forgotten. Those days are over. In fact, I'm just so engulfed in this glory. You know what? Until you said something, I'd even forgotten about them. Imagine that. Imagine being in heaven and forgetting all of the things that we lose sleep over, all of the things that worry us, all of the things that rob us of peace in heaven. I'm just so happy. I'm just so thrilled. I can't even remember. So I would advise, don't ask Job that question. He'll probably put you just in your place. Whether or not he was at peace, these words sound like he has some measure of it. This is Job in the midst of his pain. But as for me, I know that my Redeemer lives, and he will stand upon the earth at last. And after my body has decayed, yet in my body I will see God. I will see him for myself. Yes, I will see him with my own eyes. I am overwhelmed at the thought. Brothers and sisters, whatever you're going through, keep that picture of seeing the glorious God and being invited to spend eternity with him when all of the problems of this world will just dissolve like that, because we know that our Redeemer lives. Let's stand up and sing about it. I know.